Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, Presidential Debate 2.0. Will the president bring his A game, or can Romney keep the upswing on his side? We will try and handicap this town hall meeting debate. Also, Biden versus Ryan. Who won? How did it help or hurt the top of the respective tickets? Syria continues to go further into turmoil. Can this civil war light a fuse on a powder keg of disaster? Special guests today include journalist Charlie Rice and security insider and former congressional candidate Dakota Wood. That and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. And good afternoon, everybody out there in Radio Land. This is Tuesday, a nice, beautiful Tuesday here in the nation's capital. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics, America's premier roundtable political show that you've never heard of, but apparently a lot of people are listening now. I am your moderator, Justin Russell, and as they do every Tuesday, joining me to my left is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District, former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Swift. Hi, Congressman.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. And to my 11 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce who was served under last count for president. He is longtime Senate staffer, longtime Washington insider, and a very distinguished, handsome, and charming fellow at the Simpson Center is the Honorable Alan Clark. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
And to my 12 o'clock, he is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is former Floor Chief Ford Gerald R. Ford and longtime Washington insider. He is Bob Hines. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Justin. Good to be here today.
Next to him is the former executive director of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland, the longtime Washington insider, Carl Steuben. Hello, Carl.
Hello, Justin.
And joining us today is a special guest. He is a longtime journalist, former journalist for the Financial Times, now a freelance journalist here in Washington, D.C. He has interviewed several heads of state, several Washington insiders. He is Charlie Rice. Hey, Charlie, welcome.
Hey, Justin, how you doing?
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us. Let's see, what is there to talk about? Oh, yeah, that's right. It's debate night in America. It's like hockey night in Canada, but with a political undertone. It's amazing. What we've got tonight is the second of three presidential debates going on at Hofstra University up in Long Island in Massapequa. I don't even know, one of those odd-sounding cities in Long Island. But today is the town hall meeting, which will cover a variety of affairs, but it will be moderated by Candy Crowley from CNN. And a lot of talk, a lot of buzz going on about the presidential debate tonight. But let's just dive right into it. Congressman Al, I'm going to ask you, we've got an incumbent president that's coming off of a really awkward, bad, not top floor type performance.
I am being kind.
What does President Obama have to do to make up from his first showing?
Well, he's got to get real. I have never understood why he can't sell. And this is the verb that I think is most key. He hasn't sold his program in 4 years. He lays it out, describes what it is, defends it, but he never really gets in there and says, this is what Americans need. And what he needs to do in this campaign is he needs to sell his program. He needs to sell the fact that he saved General Motors. He needs to sell the fact that he arguably was the most important person in saving the economy. He needs to sell those points if he, because there ain't going to be anybody else in the room who's going to do it for him.
But Carl Steuben, didn't he try to do that in the first debate? And it almost seemed like he was apologetic for the first 4 years.
I think, he tried to do it, but I think he was really put off by Romney and the new Mitt Romney that he saw, and not the old Mitt Romney with a lot of different views and a lot of changes.
Was he shell-shocked by Mitt Romney's approach?
I have a feeling that he was shell-shocked, and I have a feeling tonight he's going to come out fighting, and he's going to hopefully talk about the future and what kind of a program he's going to do after he tells what Al said is all the achievements that this administration has made. It is not a failed administration. It has been a successful administration, and he's got to sell that also.
But Bob Hines, you know, what we've got, though, is we've got what we thought would be a president who was savvy enough to, hey, I didn't make a lot of progress. In fact, I actually took several steps back after the last performance. He kept his surrogate, or he kept his debate prep team, which was led by Senator John Kerry. Was that a smart move?
Well, it didn't turn out to be a smart move, but I don't know whether it was the let me put it this way. He's the guy. Their team can only do so much. The team can, I'm sure, gave him as many talking points and as much material and as much responses as they expected that would be useful in what they believe Mr. Romney was going to say, and he just didn't use the ammunition he had. That would be my view. I don't know if it's true, but it seems to me that, you know, he's the guy in the arena, as Teddy Roosevelt once said, and he did not do the job he's supposed to do.
Alan Moore, when we look at the last performance, and now everybody's kind of armchair quarterbacking and getting ready for this performance for tonight, a lot of people are saying that the best way that he can come back from the first performance is to get almost overly aggressive a la Joe Biden on Governor Romney. Is that a smart take tonight in a town hall format?
No.
Or is that a difficult line to cross?
No. He doesn't. He needs to drink a couple of glasses of Red Bull to get himself a bit revved up. But he does not want to become Joe Biden. It would be a laughing stock. He would look absurd and ridiculous. But in the town hall format, likability is important. He needs to be a little more aggressive, a little more assertive. Expectations for him, as we said last week, are down in the basement. So all he's got to do is be on point, push back a little bit, and be more assertive. Now, I like the way that Al and Carl think he needs to accentuate his successes. If that's what he does, it'll be a very short program.
Wow. Now, Charlie, you've been around politics and the Washington Beltway presence for a while. It seems to me that the media, in fact, has gotten a little bit almost armchair quarterbacking the debate for tonight. We're seeing a lot of media outlets pushing the fact that Obama's got to do X, Y, and Z. Is he going to be driven by the media, do you think? Does the media have that much influence in the cycle, do you think?
Well, that's a very good question. Something that I've been looking at actually is that in the last presidential debate, the president seemed like he was rather put out by the fact that he was defending
his
program. He was defending his career, and I can't remember who said it earlier, that is something he has not had to do for the last 4 years. The media in general have been fairly soft on the president. They have, as one story I read last week said, been filling in the gaps for his advocacy for selling himself. They have, in general, not been taking as hard a line with the president as they should have been, which has led to a president who is unaccustomed to selling, to defending, and to properly making the case to the voters that he allegedly serves.
Congressman Allen, is that just a lack of experience, or is there a naivete almost inside the Obama camp saying, you know, we still have hope and change, everybody loves us, we're going to get reelected?
Well, I think there's a naivete, although I'm not sure that it goes that way. The fact that, and this is something that Alan has mentioned previously, he's had so few press conferences. He really hasn't had a chance to practice doing this kind of stuff, and that, I think, has been a strategic mistake. Do I think he can pull out of it? Yes, I think he can. Will he? That's what we're all going to be watching for tonight.
But, Charlie, one of the big obstacles that the president's facing tonight is going to be economics. I mean, economics is probably going to drive this town hall meeting. You've covered economics for your various journalist outlets, including the Financial Times. It seems that the president can't get his economic package together in a nice small gift and present that to the American public, whether through the media, through debates. Is that really that much of a hurdle for the president?
I would say so. The primary issue, I think, on most people's minds is the economy. People are still out of work. I think we're still at about 8% unemployment. And the president has not delivered a clear package, economic package. He has said we have stimulus, and we had stimulus, and nothing seems to have been stimulated. Unemployment has remained extraordinarily high over the last 4 years, and there has been no indication that the president actually seems to understand how to actually get an economy moving again.
But Alan, when we look at the aspect of the economy, again, which is going to probably drive a lot of what this town hall is going to be about tonight, it seems to us that, you know, the president's caught in between a rock and a hard spot, whereas he's got to almost defend the past 4 years, which arguably successful or not, but also give a clear vision of what the next 4 years is about. The argument that he's given before is it's going to take me more than one term. Is that going to hold up, do you think, with especially in a town hall meeting tonight?
Well, I think that he, as has already been said, he needs to be more specific about what he intends to do. There are things he can do to defend what he's done, and he will no doubt cast some blame on what he inherited, cast some blame on a recalcitrant Republican Congress for the last 2 years. He won't likely make that distinction, and he'll have a point there, but what he's failed to do, we talked about his failure to make the strongest case for his record so far, and that is a failing, because he does have some things to talk about there, which he doesn't seem to talk about very well or very often. But what is his plan for the future? And what he tends to do, what he has tended to do, and the whole Democratic message is, don't go with these other guys. They're going to take us back to the failed policies of the past. And that little chorus, without substance or detail, I don't think carries the day anymore, because the other guys are getting more specific and talking more about how they're not trying to take us back, but some of the things they would do moving forward.
You know, Congressman Al, one of the things that Bill Clinton did in his debates, in fact, in his second election cycle, where he brought up the bridge to the 21st century, he provided the American public at least a baseline for what he planned to do in his second term, and it seemed like the American people bought in on that. Do you think that Obama's going to have something that sophisticated ready to go for an event like tonight, or is the town hall meeting not the appropriate time?
Well, I don't know whether it's the appropriate time or not, but let's face it, he's not Bill Clinton, and neither is Mitt Romney. Nobody's Bill Clinton but Bill Clinton, who can do remarkable things. I find it, however, unusual that we're talking about the fact that he has not explained his program when Mitt Romney hasn't explained anything about anything.
Well, we're going to get to Mitt Romney here in a second.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah, we'll get to Mitt Romney here in a second. But you know, one of the things that I do want to play is, because one of the things that was noticed by a lot of people in the first debate was President Obama's opening. It was almost lackluster. Here's President Obama, part of his opening speech.
You know, 4 years ago, we went through the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Millions of jobs were lost. The auto industry was on the brink of collapse. The financial system had frozen up. And because of the resilience and the determination of the American people, we've begun to fight our way back. Over the last 30 months, we've seen 5 million jobs in the private sector created. The auto industry has come roaring back. And housing has begun to rise.
These are not compelling arguments, or at least the president in his opening speech, after spending 10 seconds or 15 seconds of his two-minute opening celebrating the fact that it was his anniversary. Not a real compelling opening speech. he's really got to pick up the pace on this one, Congressman Al.
Well, the things he pointed out are all very important. He just didn't make them sound as important as they are.
He kind of passed over them.
He mentioned them, but he didn't sell them. That's, I get back to that word. Joe Biden talked about all those things, and he sold them.
Alan Moore.
Are we going to talk about the vice presidential debate yet? Or
no, we'll talk about that later. Give us a second on that.
We need a little fact check on that last comment.
Alan Moore and his facts. Damn your facts.
I announced that I looked astonished.
Alan Moore.
But when you make the comment that he talks about the 5 million new jobs. Oh, but wait a minute. We're down 23 million jobs. So, you start picking time frames. There are far fewer people working today than there were when the president took over. I don't blame all of that on him at all. Things were heading down. And there's, eventually things do bottom out. It's just taken a very long time. But I don't want us to get carried away with this 5 million new manufacturing jobs without putting it into the context of being down 23 million jobs.
Charlie, you heard the opening speeches. We just heard it, that soundbite. But talking about soundbites, it seems like the president himself has to have those soundbites in a teleprompter in order to get that message out. Is that hurting the president right now?
Oh.
Is that going to hurt him tonight in a town hall format?
Oh, absolutely. He was, I can't remember if he was reading specifically from a teleprompter, but he did seem extremely reliant on note cards and for prompts generally for something that should be or that he has made a hallmark, a touchstone of his reelection campaign. The auto industry is doing better. We've got more jobs. Things are, we are beginning to come back. That seems like something that he should have on the top of his head, at the tip of his tongue, every single time he gets in front of a microphone. And he sounds about as enthusiastic about it as if he were reporting the new LIBOR number.
Congressman Al, you look puzzled.
Well, I did not understand the word. I'm deaf.
LIBOR?
LIBOR.
Yeah, London Interbank Overnight Rate.
The International Finance Rate.
Oh, I forgot we got somebody here who knows.
Sorry.
But that's exactly the point.
Yeah. Exactly. Thank you for proving Charlie's point, Congressman. That was great. That was awesome. Go ahead, Alan Moore.
I wanted to say one thing about tonight's debate, because we're talking about it as though the economy is going to be the subject. The economy will no doubt come up, but remember, this is a town hall meeting, and I think this is going to be the sole forum where some of these other issues that were not addressed in the domestic policy debate, and I credit them and credit Jim Lehrer for staying with the really big issues that are confronting us, but tonight is the night where I think we're going to probably dig into matters like gay marriage, abortion, gun rights, infrastructure investment in particular areas, some of the social issues. They're all fair game, and I think that we could easily see some questions relating to such matters, because it's coming from the audience. There is a filter, but the whole idea with town hall is what's on people's minds, in addition to the economy. And, there'll be the economy, yes, but other issues too. I think we'll see a lot of variation tonight.
Bob Hines.
Well, on that point, I hope that the elections, the debate commission, is going to hopefully minimize those issues, which are really proliferate, they're subsidiary issues compared to the economy and compared to some of the foreign policy issues that are open right now. And it seems to me that I wouldn't mind having a question on each one of those issues, as long as it's just one question and the moderator makes sure that we don't get a series of the same kind of question.
Al Swift.
I don't think they should be allowed to discuss abortion unless they can come up with something new. Nothing new has been said on that issue for 5 years.
Well, wait a minute. Arguably, the Romney camp has taken a more moderate view on abortion.
They haven't said anything new about it.
The Romney camp has come out. Instead of saying it's criminalized, the Romney camp has been fairly moderate, or has moderated its tone in the general election
cycle. You're not understanding me. That issue has been debated in every conceivable little dot and dash, and there's nothing new to be said about it. Now, you're saying, well, Romney's got a new position on it. Well, hooray, he's got a new position on everything every day. What I'm suggesting is that some of these social issues have been debated to death. Everybody in America has made up their mind about them. And I think the position of the candidates is known about them, unless they want to change, as apparently Romney has. So I agree with Bob. There are more important things to talk about.
I would hope the abortion issue came up for one reason. They were asked a question last week. Ryan gave his answer. The vice president gave his answer. Now, I want to see if Romney comes up with the Ryan answer or a third or fourth answer, because he's been all over the place on abortion for the last 6 to 8 weeks, or maybe even since he began campaigning.
But there's a lot of aspects to it. We'll talk about Governor Romney here in a second, though. But as far as tonight, though, one of the big problems that President Obama's had since the first debate is the women's vote in undecided in nationwide numbers. Romney has actually polled head-to-head with undecided women voters nationwide. Congressman Alley, that's got to be a huge problem and a huge sore point, particularly with the Obama camp.
Yeah, but here is something that I read, but maybe it was in today's Post. Obama has different performances with different audiences. He is obviously great with oratory, where he's got a big, huge convention, and he's got his set speech, and he does that very well. But he's also very good in small groups. And what this article was saying, if the reporter was telling the truth, is that he really does very well on the ground when he's talking to 20, 30, 40 people, or small groups, 50, 60 people, and what have you, and gets to them one-on-one. That's going to be the format for tonight. Where he's not very good is, if you call it the press conference format, where he doesn't quite know what's coming and he isn't able to engage personally with reporters, because you don't do that.
But Bob Hines, I mean, that there's a fine line in a nationally televised debate, particularly one that is as important to the Obama camp as it is, talking and doing well in a small group. He still has to talk to the 25, 30 million people that are watching in TV land. Can he bridge that gap, do you think?
I think he can. The question is, will he? I mean, I was so shocked at the first debate that I did not fully comprehend how poorly it was until I looked. You know, I just thought about it. I was surprised that the press just stood there or put his head down. And now I can't imagine him standing around with his head down and looking at his notes while Romney's talking. I expect him to be paying attention to what Romney is saying and looking at him and being alert and looking like a guy who wants to win the presidency because he's serious about it. You know, he didn't even look like he cared last time. I cannot imagine that he will not be far better on his game physically, at least, you know, more looking like he's interested, aware, ready to jump in and say, well, I disagree because I want to see that in him. I don't see that in him.
Congressman Al.
And let me kind of underline what I said. You know, it's not that there's going to be millions of people that are watching. I'm saying that he does well talking to a small group. Right. It's a psychological thing on the part of a speaker. You know, and if he is feels comfortable talking to the smaller group, he's going to come across differently than he does in another forum, regardless of how many billions might be watching.
Well, Alan Moore.
A lot is going to depend here on how the two candidates interact, and it's not yet clear. I don't disagree with what Al said about him being fairly good in a small group, but remember what a small group is. It's a bunch of people who support you, who show up, and they ask polite questions. They nod politely. They finish, and you move to the next question.
But it is Nassau County, New York. It is Long Island. There's going to be a lot of pro-Obama.
Listen. I'm talking about the small group setting that Al is referring to. Tonight, half the people there are going to be guests of Obama Biden, and half are going to be guests of Romney Ryan. The questions are going to reflect that, and it's not just Obama with a crowd where he can give an answer and move to the next question. There's a moderator, and the two candidates are in a position where they can engage, and how much they choose to do that, we don't know. It's going to depend. It's going to depend on the question. It's going to depend on their mood. It's going to depend on how they feel. But it's not just that Obama can answer the question. Then it will be Romney's turn to answer the question, and he may take issue with what the president just said. So it's a very different setting than the normal small group of hand-picked people that the president is used to.
Carl Tooven.
You know, President Obama does well under pressure. And he is really under pressure tonight and the next debate. And I think that because of that, he's going to do extremely well. He's going to come out fighting. He's going to push back gently, not gently, who knows. But he's going to push back on what Romney says. And I think he's going to get a lot of excitement out of this. Now, on the other hand, the other team says, well, Romney does well under pressure, too. So... it's going to be very interesting to see how this all comes
out. But when we talk about the president and him working well under pressure, the president's never been in this position where he's literally had to defend his political life this way. We said it last week where, you know, traditionally Obama has been surrounded since his days in the Illinois State Senate of a lot of yes people. He's never really had to defend his political life this way. This is a new world for him, I think.
If he wants a second term, he has got to do it starting tonight. If he doesn't do it tonight, if he falls flat tonight, it could be over for him. And that's why I feel that he's really going to come out swinging. He's going to be crisp, and he's going to be fighting tough.
The one thing that we've heard a lot of the pundits talking about leading up to tonight is the idea of, we talked about, you know, the Gallup poll showing undecided women voters neck and neck, I mean, literally a 49-49 split between the two candidates, which is a huge gap margin from where Romney and Obama were, let's say, a month ago. Are they going to focus at the women vote? Are they going to try and micro-target the women vote, the minority vote, African-Americans, Hispanics? Do you think that's a possibility tonight, Bob?
Well, of course it's a possibility. You don't know what the questions are going to be. Now, if they really are questions from citizens, as opposed to, you know, reader either professional reporters or politically knowledgeable people, the kind of question you just asked, will those issues come up, is more likely in a different setting than it is in a town hall meeting where people are going to be, if they're really just, you know, they're certainly going to be interested, but if they're just regular folk, they're going to be more interested in the economy than anything else.
Charlie, talking about the location up in Long Island at Hofstra University, just outside New York City, is the locale and the venue going to be in play in this? Is there a certain inherent pro-Obama lean in that part of New York, or is it going to be hopefully totally neutral?
Well, to say that there's ever neutral ground in a political fight just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Somebody is always going to have some sort of home court advantage because that's how a campaign organizes. Campaigns don't go to places where they think they aren't going to get a fair shot, and a fair shot does not mean a neutral shot.
But this is a debate location that was picked by the Presidential Commission,
which is in turn heavily influenced by the parties themselves that get involved in the debates and the negotiations surrounding the debates. So this will probably be as close to neutral territory as one can get. That said, there will probably be a slight lean towards the president, simply because, well, it is Long Island, and it is not upstate New York. It's Long Island.
Alan Moore.
I'll just remind you that it's, they don't go out into the community and say, come on down. Come on and listen to the presidential debate. The tickets are all allocated ahead of time. The Obama team gets, let's say, 40%, and Romney gets 40%, and the students probably get 20%. So it's not this random selection of Long Islanders. There may be a disproportionate number. They'll give tickets away to their locals, but the principal audience will be kind of 50-50 divided, and then the students will be whatever students are thinking these days. So it's important to make that adjustment to the geography.
Charlie Rice, and on the subject of students, I don't know how Hofstra has allocated the selection of tickets that go to students, but I'm willing to bet that the students are going to be more politically organized, more politically active. And the students that are going to be in the
college Republicans,
they're probably going to lean more towards college Democrats than college Republicans and college Democrat allied organizations. Granted, it's been some time since I've been a college political person at all, but I'm willing to bet that the student population will skew slightly more Democrat than it will Republican.
Right. Carl Tubin, last word.
You got to remember, this is Hampstead in Nassau County. This is Hampstead, New York, in Nassau County. A little further out in the Massapequa would be a Republican territory, but this is basically Democratic territory.
Right.
But I agree with Alan. I really don't think the location is going to have that much effect one way or the other.
Now, and I cannot believe that the two co-chairs are going to see to it that it's
Sarenkaw and McCurry.
The two chairs of the debate commission. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican. They're both very fair-minded guys, and I'm sure they're going to try to see to it that both that the representatives of both teams are in the room if that's what they want. But they're going to make it sure it's as fair as it can be.
Right. Well, we're going to let that be the last word. When we come back, we're going to talk about more about the presidential debate tonight. We'll focus a little bit on Governor Romney's position and how he's managed to bridge a really big gap coming into this debate tonight. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavor cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
Thank you. digress, but who does it take to get around? No. Tell the mailman not to call. He's coming home until the fall. And then again, I might not get home at all. Lulu's back in town. Oh, that woman's back of town. Oh, my.
Water. You know, we always enjoy a little Fats Waller here. That's fantastic. Hey, this is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio from Chili's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We're going to continue our discussion about preview for tonight's town hall debate between Governor Mitt Romney and President Barack Obama up at Hofstra University in New York, out on Long Island, and the town hall format. Before we get into the other side of this, I do want to talk a little bit about the controversy surrounding Candy Crowley as a moderator tonight. Apparently, Candy Crowley from CNN has gone off the reservation and telling a lot of media outlets about what she believes her role is going to be in tonight's debate. That has ruffled some feathers over at the debate commission, including co-chairs McCurry and Fahrenkopf. I want to go to you, Charlie Rice. As a journalist, what is the expected role of Candy Crowley in moderating tonight's debate, particularly, you know, somebody of Candy Crowley's stature?
Mm-hmm. Well, the expected role is frankly just slightly more than timekeeper, trying to make sure that the candidates speak for approximately the same amount of time, not necessarily giving pushback, but occasionally asking for follow-up for more in-depth responses to questions that have already been asked. That's the expected role. That said, it might be nice to have on-the-spot fact-checking in a maybe not necessarily a town hall, but in the presidential debates.
Isn't that Candy Crowley coming off the reservation saying that she's going to be an active participant in moderating the debate in this town hall format, or are they being a little hard on Candy?
I think they might be being a little bit hard. Presidential candidates, vice presidential candidates, are prone to enjoying the sound of their own voices, and the role of glorified timekeeper might better be served by having somebody who does provide a bit more pushback to the candidates when they're making their statements.
Alan Moore,
what her role might ideally be is something we could all discuss. The problem is there's a contract, and the contract spells out specifically what she is and is not allowed to do. And what she is clearly not allowed to do in the contract language, which you can find out on the internet, is to do pushback, follow-up questions, and so on. That is specifically not permitted under the agreement. My hunch is that by the time we get to tonight, she will decide that her career doesn't need a bunch of anger from both presidential teams and camps, and that she will have been reminded of what she signed up to and will be very, very cautious to go beyond the timekeeping and handling of the questions role. I'm not defending that as the best use of a moderator. I remember Tom Brokaw 4 years ago, who did the town hall meeting, said, "I'll never do that again because you're a glorified timekeeper." But at the same time,
Tom Brokaw also asked follow-up questions in that same event.
When you sign up for that, you have to honor what you sign up to do. So I'll be really surprised if, however frustrated she might be, she goes way off the reservation.
Congressman Al.
What surprises me is she was talking about it ahead of time. You know, Jim Lehrer took a lot of crap and a lot of criticism for what he did, and afterwards he defended his position and explained why, some new rules and da-da-da-da-da. And you either agree with him or not. But he waited until afterwards to defend rather than to do it ahead of time and predict. And it just seems very unprofessional to me for her to have said anything about how she was going to handle it.
Well, let's talk about that. Go ahead, Bob.
Let's get it this way. If, in fact, she intends to be active beyond the contract, I mean, literally, she is she is going to be in trouble long term. Now, because there is a contract, her responsibilities are spelled out in it. If she didn't want to sign it, she didn't have to. She could have let somebody else be the moderator if she wanted to.
What are they going to do if she...
But if she starts stepping out, you know, too far outside the boundaries, it's going to...
What are they going to do, bring in their lawyers in the middle of the program?
No.
Sure, but they'll never invite her back.
Yeah, right. And that might be the end of her debate moderation career, her own access.
And she's not going to want that to happen. She is a professional. She wants to be involved in this kind of thing in the future. She doesn't want her bosses at what ABC or ABC?
CNN.
She doesn't want her bosses to, let's say, minimize her responsibilities compared to what she might be doing. I mean, she is a major
player in Washington.
A major player, but that doesn't give her a right to violate a contract that she has signed. I sound like a lawyer. I am a lawyer, but that's what I think.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see. Congressman Allen.
I don't think the lawyers are going to have anything to do with it. If she goes off in the middle of the program, all they can do is criticize her afterwards and maybe not pay her. I don't know what's in the contract.
Right.
I can't read her mind, and she's going to do what she's going to do.
Arguably, Candy Crowley is one of the staples in the Washington press corps. She's been a fantastic member, and she's been very aggressive, but very balanced in her coverage of Washington politics. But let's go to Governor Romney's point real quick. Alan Moore, what does Governor Romney have to do to really secure and possibly put him over the top leading into election night November?
Well, I put over the top is beyond any one person's ability. He would need a lot of help from the other side. I'm guessing he's going to get less help than he did the last time, because I'm intrigued with Carl's notion that when he's really under pressure, he delivers. I think he will do better than he did last time, but I think he was under a lot of pressure last time, and he did not deliver. He fundamentally failed. It wasn't like that was just a trip to a ball game. He really, really messed up. Now, I think he believes that now, and he's going to try to figure out now how do I restore something in a whole different kind of format with questions coming from a lot of different people. As for Romney, you know, he acted like the more mature statesman in the room last time, and he got, as I say, he got a lot of help from Obama, so he exceeded expectations. Obama came short, and we saw the effect, and that effect is lingering. So what Romney needs to do is not necessarily be on the tack, be firm, make his points, be prepared for a lot of new subjects to come up, be prepared for the president to take some shots, and you have to believe that in the practice sessions both of these guys have had, they have gone over hundreds of questions, hundreds of possible answers, hundreds of best responses, and Romney needs to maintain his demeanor, his focus, his articulate presentation, and the president has to up his game. So I'm looking for Romney to kind of hold firm at where he was, and Obama to rise up.
Congressman Al.
If I were one of Romney's debate coaches, what I would worry about is, yes, he did significantly exceed expectations. In the process, he has raised expectations for this performance. And it means he's got to kind of top himself. And given that he gave a very good presentation, that may be difficult to do. So that by comparison, he could look worse, even though he might not be.
Bob Hines.
Well, you know, if you assume that he is as on his game as he was in the previous debate, you have to, we all probably believe that, you know, Obama's bound to do better. The margin of difference is going to be much closer. So it's going to be, we could very well end up with, you know, like a tie or something in the public mind or in the media's mind. But The reality is, if Romney can do as well as he did 10 days ago, and maybe just be a little sharper in a couple of areas, but fundamentally be as good as he was, he doesn't have to do much. You know, how much better can you do, so to speak? Now, if there's a bobble that the president makes that he can take advantage of, that's one thing. I don't really expect that to happen. I expect the president to be better than he was.
But Bob, this is a town hall format. It's going to be hard for either Obama or Romney to go directly on the attack in this type of format. Is that something that you think maybe Rob Portman has taken into consideration in preparing Mitt Romney?
I am absolutely sure that Rob Portman has done everything you can possibly do. He is very, very methodical.
Very interesting.
Yeah, he's very good.
Charlie Rice, we saw a very centrist type Mitt Romney in the Denver debate. Do you think that that's going to be a continuation tonight?
That's a very good question, and one to which I have no answer, I'm afraid. No immediate answer. It seems likely that Mitt Romney has sort of swung to the middle on a lot of things, and we can expect probably to see a continuation of that, although if the president decides to play up a more liberal and more progressive platform, or say espouse a platform, we might actually see Romney swing more to the right.
I pose the same question to you, Alan Moore. We saw a very centrist Mitt Romney in Denver. Do you think that we'll see that same tone in Mitt Romney tonight in Hofstra?
Absolutely. I mean, this is behavior that is time tested for both candidates. Ever since we've had a strong primary system where the true believers of both parties play a disproportionate role in the nominating process, you have Democrats who veer left in the primaries and move back towards the center in the general election, and it's the opposite with Republicans. They veer right to get the nomination, and they swing back towards the center. No big surprise here. Now, some people who drink the Kool-Aid like to call that flip-flopping, but in fact, we have seen that kind of movement, massaging, as long as we've had really active primaries.
Bob Hines.
Where are the undecided voters? They're usually in the middle. We know what the liberals think. We know what the Tea Party Republicans think, the conservatives think. They're pretty well locked in. They have been for several months, probably. Now, you know, now that both candidates are identified, now that the Republicans have made their decision. The fact of the matter is that that portion of the electorate that is still trying to finalize their decision are people who are not partisans, hard left or hard right. They're mainstream, middle of the road folks who don't watch politics all the time and don't worry about it, but they want to know that their president knows what they're worried about, which is probably the economy more than anything else. And if they hear some good answers from that, those answers are in the middle. They always are. The reality is that both parties, you know, both candidates tend to move toward the middle and on both extremes. Both parties have extremes who are not as happy as they'd like to be with their candidate because he is not espousing their left or right views. But the point is, you move to the middle when you want to get elected.
Congressman Al, you kind of cringed a couple of times during that last interaction.
Well, I'm really cringing. I can't disagree with anything that Alan or Bob has said because that's standard political science. But Romney is not your typical flip-flopper. He has got a record that starts out running against Ted Kennedy, saying he was more liberal than Ted Kennedy. And then he's moderated, and then he went to the far, far right, and then he changed lots of positions over this time. And I would think that Obama may well come equipped with many examples of where not flip-flop, but just change. And if I were him, I would try to set that up and then leave the question, you know. So what he says tonight, is that what he's going to be saying, you know, in the next debate? And is that what he would do as president, or is he going to change all over again? I think that is a form of attack that could work.
Bob Hines?
Nothing to say on that.
Okay. Carl Toobin, you look like you had a statement you want to give out.
I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, you know, John Kennedy ran to the right when he was in the Democratic primaries in 1960, came into the middle, and I agree with all that. But I do think that if Romney, for some reason, goes back to the right and starts talking about some of his views that he had six, eight, 10 weeks ago, that he's going to be in trouble.
And I think the president should, if Romney doesn't bring them up, which I think is unlikely, the president should.
But this brings up a very delicate question for both camps. Does Obama go on the offensive as his campaign ads have done in recent weeks, especially after the Denver debate? Does Obama go after Romney's character and Romney's stance in the primary? Bob Hines.
I think he will. Yeah, I think he'll try to show examples of flip-flopping.
Will we hear the 47% come up tonight?
I would be surprised if we didn't.
Is that something, do you think that this is the format to do that?
Well, I don't know if it's the format to do it or not, but it certainly is the opportunity.
Well, I can't imagine that either of these guys aren't skilled enough to take whatever question is asked and turn it around to where they can talk about anything they want.
But, I mean, or Alan Moore, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think, as we have already said, this is going to be a much tougher setup, I believe, for them to engage each other. Mm. Having said that, I would expect that the 47% issue is more likely to come from the audience than from the president. If it does come up, he will then have a chance to use whatever talking point they've agreed is the most powerful indictment of Romney for that statement that he made once back in May that was secretly taped. And never before or since, so far as I've heard from anybody who's tried to figure that out, and yet we hear that somehow represents what he certainly thinks and has always thought. I mean, that's the problem. And Romney, with writing too hard on that, and Romney has disavowed that comment, and I am sure he's got, as Al suggests, a good additional response should it come up. These guys... are prepared, well, they have gone through preparation that has touched on many, 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 many more issues than they're going to be able to handle. Will they remember what they hope to say? Will it be there at the moment? Will it come to them? That's a challenge that has to do with skills, practice, and serendipity.
One of the things that everybody's talking about, though, from the Denver debate for Mitt Romney, is the fact that he described a general path forward. Now, Democratic pundits are going out saying, oh, it's all smoke and mirrors. Republican pundits are coming out saying he's the only one that's brought forward. It's not the apologies for the past. It's actually a line forward. But can Romney truly show tonight in this format that he can be the agent for change, Bob Hines?
Of course he can. I mean, Al said it very well. There's bound to be questions that are going to give him a chance to touch on the answer and then say something that's related to it that he wants to get out. It is not a problem. I mean, and look at it this way, too. Let's say the president is asked a question, he answers it. I'm sure that Romney is going to have a chance, and vice versa. The other speaker is going to have a chance to respond to the answer of the person who was asked the question. there's going to be an opportunity, because the way you're going to get a discussion of the economy is somebody ask one of them what they're going to do, and they'll say something, and the other person is going to say, well, let me tell you what I'm going to do.
Well, let me talk real quick in the last 4 minutes. One of the things that tends to happen in prior debates, we keep going back to the Carter-Reagan debates in 1980, where we saw a poor showing by Jimmy Carter, then incumbent president, against Ronald Reagan. He came back in the second debate and almost overcompensated. Is that a risk, Congressman Al, for Obama tonight, that he might try and overcompensate his performance from Denver?
Well, I think particularly given that this format is not the same as the first debate, that becomes a problem, and I'm certain that it's one that they have thought about, talked about, and have a strategy for.
Okay. We're coming up on the top of the hour. This is happy hour for us, so we're going to go ahead and order our drinks, cut open our cigars, light them up, and get ready for our second half. When we come back, we're going to have special guest Dakota Wood. He'll be talking about, among other things, the situation in Syria, and also give us his take on the debate tonight. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches, they've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
you know, we're sitting here listening to the Joyner music and listening to the very, very influential big band leader. Oh my God,
Count Basie.
I had a brain meltdown there for a second. But this is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Our guest, Dakota Wood, is actually traveling back from Stillwater. He'll be back at his house, and he'll join us for our last half hour. But we're going to shift gears a little bit. We want to talk a little bit about the vice president's debate that happened between Vice President Joe Biden and Congressman and Chairman of the Budget Committee. Vice President Joe Biden and Chairman Paul Ryan. I got to be careful with that. It's a tongue twister. But interesting debate last week for the sole purpose that anytime you put Joe Biden in front of a camera, it's going to be good watching. And Papa Joe didn't let us down last week. Congressman Al, I'll go to you first. It seemed like Papa Joe was just out swinging. He's a junkyard dog. Is that a misrepresentation, or is that just who he is?
He was not a junkyard dog. He was very aggressive. The thing that puzzled me, and I am in a decided minority in this regard, I thought the smiling worked. He's got a great smile. He's got a great set of teeth, I thought it worked well. But a good friend of mine, who is a very strong Democrat, had to leave the room because she said it reminded him of the shark in the Nemo movie. And I find that there are more people that agree with her than agree with me. Now, I remember when I worked in the television station and the new season would come out, every program I liked would only last about 3 weeks. So I am sometimes not the best judge of these things, but I thought he was strong, that I didn't pick up that he was in any way being inappropriate.
Bob Hines.
I thought he was strong, too, on substance. I disagree with his facts a couple of times, but he was strong in his presentation, and he was good. But once he stopped talking, and he started grinning and smiling,
laughing out loud, and interrupting.
Yeah, and I thought that he lost some of his success. I think that probably Al's right that there are more people who thought it was a little bit over the top than thought it was perfectly appropriate. But it was certainly a stronger, He grimaced when he didn't like an answer, and it just wasn't the best way to operate, I think, because it showed a little bit of, I think, you know, you almost want to say immaturity. I mean, you know, but he's been in politics for years, and this is his style. Let's face it, that's how he's always been.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question. I mean, we loved Papa Joe Biden because he's Papa Joe Biden.
What surprises me is that the folks who were helping him didn't suggest that you know, show him some pictures of previous, you know, things like this, and give him a chance to recognize that it might be a little bit over the top.
But this was not the Al Gore of the deep sighs and the rolling eyes.
This was not the lockbox Al Gore.
No, thank God.
Carl Thuvin.
I agree with Al. I thought the smiling had a purpose. And I think he did it. He was trying to kind of show how he felt when Ryan was going off on some of his tangents. And I thought it was very effective. Tonight, I think you're going to have the president be aggressive without the smiles. But you know, that's it. But I thought Joe did a wonderful job. And
the president has a good set of teeth, too, and he needs to be careful how he uses
it.
Alan Moore.
Both guys did much of what they needed to do. Both guys appealed to the partisans. The Democrats were very disappointed in the president and his lackluster performance. So we have a jived up, revved up, Joe Biden, who's pushing back, he's aggressive, And I think most Democrats thought, finally, somebody speaking up and taking the fight to the other side. Ryan had a different objective, which I think he succeeded at, which was to show that he could hold his own on that stage, subject matter, behavior-wise, dealing with the vice president. The real question, though, is how did the two men come across to that big group of undecideds? For guidance on that, I would suggest go to Saturday Night Live. Go to any of the nighttime comics who had more fun than you can possibly believe with, let's face it, guys, the bizarre, over-smiley Joe Biden, who was condescending, who interrupted. The Dems loved it because they'd had this passive president. But I think that people who hadn't decided thought, you know, we can say, oh, that's old Joe, who we know and we love and stuff. I think people who haven't paid a lot of attention to Joe looked at that and thought, oh, that's Biden? And with Ryan, they were just getting to know him in the first place. And he wasn't perfect. He was a little stiff. He was a little wonky.
And by the way, he was drinking water like he just walked out of the Mojave Desert.
You know, and that's one thing that Saturday Night Live,
the big water cooler thing,
was a gigantic glass of water that he poured down in one gulp. But I thought that Biden was over the top for those undecided folks. That was my take on it. They both did what they needed to do for their main constituencies, but I'm thinking that Biden wasn't altogether perfect for the undecided.
Well, let's look at the substance quality of it. As chairman of the Budget Committee, I mean, a lot of people look at Paul Ryan as being, you know, the economic brain behind a lot of what the Republicans are trying to tout in this presidential campaign. Although he's said numerous times, I still serve at the pleasure of Mitt Romney in this. Did he come across as having a solid base in communicating the go-forward plan of what the economics of the future are going to look like, or did he miss the boat on that?
I don't think he missed the boat, and I think he was pretty good. Now, you know, he certainly wasn't as colorful as the vice president, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean, he was more...
Wonky
is a good word. Yeah, wonky. Thank you, Al. He was wonky a little bit, but he was also substantive, and I think a lot of it got through. I think he talked enough substance, and he talked enough economic what has to be done that it was useful and helpful that he did it.
Carl Toobin, you're shaking your head.
I don't think he came over that well, and I don't think he explained things. But I don't think he explained enough, because they never do. You know, they keep saying, well, you know, we don't have time to explain, we don't have this to explain, we're going to take it up with Congress, which I think is wrong. Also, on foreign policy, he was given phrases to use, and he blew the phrases. So, you know, I think it was his first vice presidential debate. He probably will have more in the future. But I just don't think he came across as well as he should have.
Charlie, you've covered economics here in Washington during your time here as a journalist. Who won the debate as far as the economic side, in your opinion? Did Paul Ryan truly show his colors, or did Joe Biden have a leg up on him?
I think they both showed some color, as has been observed. Chairman Ryan was very wonky. And that's good. To me anyway, it indicates that he knows what he's talking about, that he has a command of the facts that is very useful, especially when talking about economic policy, which can be, hell, is very complicated. Vice President Biden, in his non-comments, when he wasn't speaking, he chose some rather inopportune times to laugh, smile, and generally be
condescending.
The malarkey line, for one. He tended to laugh and smile when Ryan was talking about things like job losses. and failures to create new jobs, things that are not really going to sell well in terms of broader economic policy. One doesn't want to be shown as happy when talking about people losing jobs.
Good point. Congressman Al, you're shaking your head.
I didn't think he showed he was being happy about loss of jobs. I think he was saying that he was kind of amazed and amused at what Ryan was saying and how he was trying to defend it. Now, maybe that didn't come across. That's how I interpreted it. I'm biased. I'm one of those Democrats that enjoyed it. But it just seemed to me people read him cynically, and that was the wrong way to read it.
You know, when we talk about it, I mean, there was a big differential that we saw between the two candidates. I mean, even Mitt Romney is definitely pushing the way forward, as did Paul Ryan. You know, if we go back, in fact, we've got a clip from Romney's opening back in Denver that kind of tied into what Paul Ryan was saying. Let's listen to that real quick.
I've had the occasion over the last couple of years of meeting people across the country. I was in Dayton, Ohio, and a woman grabbed my arm, and she said, "I've been out of work since May. Can you help me?" Ann yesterday was at a rally in Denver, and a woman came up to her with a baby in her arms and said, "Ann, my husband has had 4 jobs in 3 years, part-time jobs. He's lost his most recent job, and we've now just lost our home. Can you help us?" And the answer is yes, we can help. But it's going to take a different path, not the one we've been on, not the one the president describes as a top-down cut taxes for the rich. That's not what I'm going to do.
You know, we hear that. Paul Ryan did a good job of bringing that message forward from Denver for the Romney-Ryan ticket. He brought up the fact of Scranton, Pennsylvania, which Joe Biden loves invoking. He asked Joe Biden, you know, "Do you know the unemployment rate in Scranton?" Joe Biden came back and said, "Yeah, I do." Paul Ryan kind of trumped him and said, "Hey, it's 10%. When you got into office, it was 8%. It just seems like Biden didn't really have a good, concise response to that attack. Am I misreading that, Bob?
Well, I would say as a quick response, it's pretty hard to have a response to that when you have to admit that things have gone bad in your own hometown by, you know, 20% or so. So, you know, that was a good little jab, if you will, but I think
it was a good gotcha.
Yeah, it was a good one. It was a fair one.
But did it carry the message forward of the path forward is not with the current administration, it's with change?
Well, it's an example of the reason why we need to do something else. And get a new team and do it.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I mean, both guys scored points. They got their jabs in. There were Biden for all of the strange facial gestures and so on, some of which unfortunately we would never see, but for the split screen. I'm not a huge fan of the split screen, but it is what it is, and both camps obviously have agreed with that. But both these guys had scored some points. Last week we said, this is not that big a deal for the election, but it had significance. It gave Democrats a chance to say, "We're fighting back." It gave Republicans a chance to say, "See, our guy knows what he's talking about. He can be respectful." And they both screwed up some. There was a lot more fact-checking going on afterwards on things that Biden said than on things that Ryan said, and some of that had to do with Benghazi, Libya, Social Security, contraception. I mean, there's, and I'm not saying that meant that there weren't questions that came up about some of what Ryan said, but it's another measure of sort of the aftermath.
Well, I want to talk about the contraception issue here in a second, but Charlie, I want to ask you, from a media standpoint, is the split screen something new to this debate cycle? It's giving us a full blown vision of both candidates as they appear on stage. Is the media really taken in by that, or is that actually something that we have to blame? We have an electorate with a short attention span.
What do you mean by is the media taking it?
Well, is the media driving the split screen? Are they approaching it as we have to win ourselves, sell this debate to an electorate with arguably a short attention span?
Sorry, I just saw something shiny across the room. I liked the split screen. I thought it was very helpful. I liked getting a fuller picture of what was going on at the podium. At the table. I enjoyed that. I don't think it was pandering to a short attention span or the media trying to sell a debate more heavily than it maybe should have. I enjoyed it. I like being able to see, the more I can see of what's going on at an event when I'm not there, the more I'm going to enjoy watching it, the more I'm actually going to pay attention to both what's being said and how it's being said and how it's being reacted to.
Congressman Al, is that almost a tool to appeal to that undecided vote, that 15% of undecided voters that's out there?
Split screen is the split screen.
Is the split screen a tool that the undecided voter can use?
I don't understand that question. Let me answer another one then. Before. The split screen, I like the split screen too. And I got a different reaction than a lot of people did. But whether that, the reason you had that, in my judgment, is that the people who were deciding how to make this good television decided that split screen was a good technique. And it was successful. I thought that made it more interesting and so forth. I don't think there was any plot. I don't think anybody was thinking that this was going to necessarily affect undecided voters or any of that. It was just some producer somewhere said this is going to make it more interesting television, and they were successful.
Alan Moore.
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure that it was a producer. I'm guessing that both camps agreed that would be what the feed looked like. I mean, both camps really have a huge role in deciding how many debates, subject for the debates, moderators for the debates, set up on the stage, seated, standing, town hall meeting, and there's only a single feed that is provided to everybody, so they all get the same thing. And I don't know this for certain, but I would be very surprised if both camps didn't agree to the split screen, and they're probably in both cases second guessing themselves now, but and also trying to figure out how to prepare and remind both candidates, be careful how you're looking when the other guy is talking. And it looked to me like in this case, in this week, that Ryan was told, you know, don't show emotion and so on, and he had kind of a half smile. It looked a little like a smirk. And it's like if Biden was prepped, then I'm guessing he just forgot.
Right. Congressman Al.
Well, I was originally a television producer.
Right.
Somewhere at a tiny little television station, you know, that nobody ever heard of. And I really believe that, of course, they had to agree with all of this, but I'll bet you the guy that was producing this was in there pushing hard for a split screen, and it wasn't to help anybody or hurt anybody. It was to make television better.
Bob Hines.
In my former life as an executive of NBC, I can tell you that I would be very surprised if the networks wouldn't be pushing for that kind of opportunity to get reaction. I mean, that's part of what television is. Somebody says something and people react to it, and I would be very surprised if they didn't want that to happen. Now, if the Democrats feel, or the Republicans feel, that they don't want to have next time, they don't want to have their guy maybe make a mistake like I think Mr. Biden may have made, I think, you know, the candidates will say we don't want to do that, and I make you a bet the producers come right back and say no, We've done it before. It's the way to do it. It gives you a more full opportunity to see the candidates, both when they're talking and when they're reacting to their opponent. And I think they'll make the same case and the same effort the next time.
Congressman Al?
And I believe that what I'm arguing here is there was no plot. I think this was just strictly a television. I'm reminded of a line of a dear old friend of mine who said, "Do not ascribe to conspiracy that for which stupidity will suffice for an answer." And you can replace the word stupidity with any number of other words. But I think there was no plot on anybody's part to make anybody look bad or get advantage.
Alan Moore.
I totally agree. I don't believe that there was any conspiracy. And I also believe that all the TV people would say, "Let's do it." The only thing I'm maintaining is I believe that both camps agreed. They both signed off.
Well, they had to.
That's
right.
That's all I'm saying.
But the question,
they also could have said no.
Well, it seems like the split screen in the vice president debate and the debate in Denver, it hurt Obama. It didn't do any favors to Joe Biden or to Paul Ryan. In fact, Alan, I think you might ascertain it even hurt Biden.
I think it hurt Biden with undecideds, and as Al talked about with people, you know, who are Obama people, thought they were seeing the shark from Finding Nemo. It was a little discomforting even for Obama fans, but they might have said, "Well, that's Joe. I'm glad he's not the main candidate."
Well, when we talk about the substance, though, I mean, they covered a variety of issues, but I wanted to talk about an issue that came up towards the end of the vice presidential debate, where the moderator, I'm at a loss for her name.
Martha Raddatz.
Martha Raddatz from ABC. Martha came out and asked a simple question about Catholicism, both devout Catholics, and their role in governing. They talked about abortion. It almost seemed like they both embraced their Catholicism, but they kind of took a different track in saying, Joe Biden, not so much the part of governance. Did that help Biden? Alan Moore?
You know, this is a very hard one, and it's not just Catholics who are paying attention and listening. I was always troubled when John Kerry said, "Well, my religious beliefs say no abortion, but I don't believe my religious beliefs should control my political views." I always found that kind of offensive. It was like, I don't have any personal views on the matter. It's only my religion. Biden took a stance, which many people have, which is, I don't believe in abortion in my personal life, but I don't believe I should impose my religious views on everyone. What Ryan said was, "My views on abortion are informed by my religious views, but that's not the only thing that informs me. I believe it is taking human life. Regardless of my religion, that's why I oppose it." There's room there for just about everybody to find some level of comfort. And there are many Catholics who share the Biden view, and there are many Catholics who share the Ryan view. There are many non-Catholics, non-believers, who are on both sides of the issue as well.
Carl Tubin.
But Ryan also went on to say that we believe that that it shouldn't be judges making these decisions. It should be elected officials, and that in a Romney Ryan administration,
they basically push it down to the state.
They want states to
right. States' rights issue versus federal issue.
Let states make the
decision. Correct. All in all, when we look at it, we got 5 minutes left in the segment, go around the table. I want to ask Congressman Al, did Paul Ryan help the Romney Ryan ticket in that debate?
Yes, I think he did, in the sense that he demonstrated that he was a competent person, he was decidedly not the governor, former governor of Alaska. he was a credible, sensible person, whether you agreed with him, and I strongly disagreed with him, but he wasn't. He was sensible.
Bob Hines, I'm going to ask you the question: did Joe Biden help gap the undecided bridge for the Obama-Biden ticket?
I think that Joe Biden did the one thing that he had to do, and that was he made the Democrats feel that, you know, that they were, you know, the president had a bad night, but by God, you know, Joe's in here, you know, taking a good swing at things and doing what he had to do. And that's important.
Congressman Al.
And I think Biden was particularly effective toward the end when he, in fact, stopped smiling and talked about the humanity of government policy, how it affects normal people and regular people. I thought he stated that very, very effectively.
That was his best time of the night.
Yeah, and I think that would have had some impact on undecideds.
Carl Toobin.
I think also at the different times on different issues, when he said, who are you going to trust? And in a sense, trust us. I thought that was very good.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, the problem for me was that he said that a few too many times. You can say that once, but he said it, you know, trust your gut, follow your instincts, who you're going to trust. I think that's a kind of a one-time thing. It's clear that Biden won the Democrats. It's clear that Ryan won the Republicans. I still maintain, not 100-9 to one, but with more than 50%, Ryan won the undecideds.
Well, we're going to let that be the last word. When we come back, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the continuing deteriorating situation in Syria, as well as a couple of other topics with our special guest, Dakota Wood. And we will be back in 3 minutes. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Everybody knows Shelley's Back Room for its corporate events, its happy hours, its famous campfire wings and fruit cigars and drinks. But what you didn't know is that Shelley's is open during the weekend, too. In fact, Shelley's Back Room on the weekends even has a non-smoking section. You can bring your family, your kids, enjoy the same campfire wings and same glorious food that you enjoy during the week, but without the famous Shelley's cigar environment. Also, during the weekend, it's football season. That means a lot of the regulars come down and enjoy their drinks and their favorite cigars, all while watching their favorite local teams, whether it's the Ravens, the Redskins, on several HD screens throughout the place. So remember, Shelley's Back Room, it's not just for happy hours anymore. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., official sponsor of Backroom Politics.
No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the elevation, on the shelf. Hey, misbehaving, saving my love for you, and you, especially you, yeah. I know for certain, the one I love, I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. Hey, misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Like Jack Horner, in a corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kisses are worth waiting for. Believe me, I don't stay out late, no place to go. I'm home about 8 at my little radio. Hey, misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, yes, you. All my love for you. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
And we're back here live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to change gears right now. We're going to talk about some international affairs stuff. Joining us right now from his home in Claremore, Oklahoma, is former senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis, former congressional candidate and longtime Washington insider, He is the former Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Marine Corps, Dakota Wood. Dakota, how you doing?
Doing well. Glad to be on the show today.
Glad to have you. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Dakota, want to touch back into your CSBA days and talk about the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis. Want to go back and I want to get your take on what's happening in both Syria and Libya. Let's talk about Syria first. The situation in Syria has really, really digressed into a quagmire. Recently, there's been some shelling in between the borders of Turkey and Syria. The civil war seems being spread outside of the Syrian borders. Why is that a problem, and why should Americans be nervous about that?
Well, it creates a situation where other actors are dragged into the fight who wouldn't otherwise want to be involved. I mean, so it's kind of like if you consider Vietnam, if it had stayed within the borders of North and South Vietnam, it's one thing. Once the North Vietnamese started using the jungle trail system, the Ho Chi Minh Trail is what it was called, into Cambodia and Laos, then you have to make a decision if you're the U.S., do you extend operations into those surrounding countries? What are the diplomatic ramifications, et cetera? So in Syria, where you have the rebels using Turkish territory to arrest, refit, rearm, where you have refugees going from Syria into Turkey, and then you have cross-border shelling from Syria into some of these areas in Turkey, it begs the question of whether Turkey is going to put up with that or get actively involved in the fight. If a fight breaks out with Turkey, Turkey is part of NATO. NATO has already said that they would come to Turkey's defense if Syria attacks. The U.S. is part of NATO. So you can see how this cascades into a multiplayer event well beyond the boundaries of Syria proper.
Dakota, there's been some recent activity in the U.S. military in reinforcing the areas around Syria, including a buildup of troops on the frontier with Syria. Is that a sign that we're ready to pull the trigger on the NATO act of attack one, attack all?
I think it's designed to create options for the U.S. One, if you have people on the ground, you can get ground truth. So developing the intel picture is critically important rather than relying on press reports exclusively or just, the good faith comments made by the governments involved, whether it's Turkey or Syria, Lebanon, you name it. So if you have your own people on the ground, they can send reports back to you. If things evolve to a point where you want U.S. Forces actively involved, either in fire support or troops on the ground or you name it, you've warmed up the engine, so to speak. You have relationships. You've got a nascent network that you can plug into instead of a very cold start. So I think introducing specialized units or individuals that create that groundwork, you don't have to flip the switch to on. You can delay as long as the situation, warrants. But it gives you an option that you wouldn't have otherwise.
With the Syria situation, I mean, obviously Assad has extended his lifespan as the head of government in Syria.
Oh, I lost you guys. We're still there?
Yeah, still here. Can you hear us?
Yeah, there we are.
President Assad of Syria has extended his life capacity as the head of state of Syria, even to the chagrin of many here in Washington. How is Assad able to maintain power in Syria and expand the fight into Turkey?
Yeah, well, he's got the preponderance of firepower. That's what it comes down to. He's got an air force. He has heavy artillery. He has armored systems, tanks, heavy armored vehicles, mobile artillery, self-propelled artillery, those kinds of things. So the sheer firepower that he has access to, that the insurgent or the rebel forces don't have in as great a quantity, plus he has a formalized military structure, that follows orders, and you've got this understood hierarchy in there, again, something that the insurgent force doesn't have. It's still kind of a ragtag group of folks. Who's in charge? How do you coordinate military actions? What access do you have to munitions and the heavier firepower? So the advantage is Assad's in that thing. So where you have the preponderance of firepower, you've got the ability to extend your lifespan. And so that's what he's relying on. And to the extent that he continues to get support from Russia and Iran, that lengthens his lifeline.
Coda, Heinz's got a question for you.
Sure.
I got a question for you. It strikes me that the administration may have made a mistake early on.
I'm sorry, guys. If you can hear me, it sounds like the connection from your end is cutting out.
Try it again.
Justin, sorry.
You're not hearing us?
I'm not hearing you. I just heard that, obviously, but the question. But it sounded like you were saying the administration may have missed an opportunity.
Without the idea of putting ground troops in there, what we've done is create a no-fly zone so they couldn't use all those weapons they were using against the rebels, and it would have probably toppled the government, and we'd probably be rid of the guy by now, Assad by now. We didn't do that when we had an opportunity to a long time ago, and don't want to see troops on the ground, certainly. I thought to myself, we missed an opportunity to get rid of a real bad guy, and the longer this fight goes on, the more we seem to be finding Islamicists and folks and stuff like that getting involved in this struggle, and it seems to be we're going to have a disaster. And I'm just unhappy that we didn't do something early on, like I said, suggesting a no-fly zone to stop killing so many people. Is that just a crazy idea, or is there any reason to think we really did make a mistake?
I think we did miss an opportunity. I think it points to the danger of timidity in your foreign policy approach. You're not you, but I mean, in the country's foreign policy approach, and that if you have confidence in who you are and what your interests are, it lends courage and conviction in pushing forward a strong agenda. So I think what happened here was a real hesitancy to get let down, yet another Middle East war. Everybody's tired of that. They don't want to do it. Trying to see how things evolve. But in situations like this, oftentimes the real thugs, the radicalized militant Islamists that you had mentioned, have strength in the ferocity. And where you have other elements that want to overthrow Assad, but they would be much more moderate, maybe almost democratically oriented, usually they have a weaker hand just because of the nature of that particular type of approach. And if you don't encourage those things, those guys, and if you don't give them the ability to really grow some roots, then you've missed a window of opportunity, just like we didn't provide support to protesters in Tehran. We didn't provide early support on the ground to the better elements in the overthrow in Libya and in other places. I think we missed this opportunity that you've mentioned. Now, the advisors to any president are going to do a lot of what-ifing. If we do this, what are the potential consequences? And we can sit on the sidelines and say, establishing a no-fly zone would be the way to go. But then you are buying into the problem, in for a penny, in for a pound. So if you are controlling the airspace and some kind of an atrocity continues to occur on the ground, you are then in a position to aid one side or the other. And as you take each step deeper into that morass, it gets you more and more involved. And now you're faced with this problem of, when do I extricate myself? How do I do that? What share of the blame do I have if the whole house of cards falls down? So unless they're going to be aggressive and courageous in getting directly involved in what's going on diplomatically, economically, and militarily, the other end of that spectrum is to not get involved at all. And I think that's the approach this administration is taking, and we're seeing the consequences of that on the ground.
Alan, question for you, Dakota.
Yeah, Dakota.
Yes, sir.
In thinking about that, I'm also realizing that from the Romney campaign either on mistakes made in Syria, a new aggressive no-fly zone should be created.
I got from the no-fly zone created with the Romney campaign. Is there more to it?
I was just saying that I think both sides.
Well, right now, I mean, I can't hear the rest of the question, but if you can hear me, I'll continue. I think the gist is, you know, neither campaign is really coming out aggressively with an alternative course of action. And part of that is the result of the mistakes made up front. We have a mess that we have right now. You can't go back in history to recreate starting circumstances. And I think what the Romney camp or what Romney is concerned about is if he advocates on the ground or more aggressive U.S. involvement, then the Obama camp will just paint him as another Bush-type individual who wants to get involved in another endless, you know, long-running, very convoluted ground war in the Middle East. Having extricated ourselves from Iraq and now trying to get out of Afghanistan, the last thing the public might tolerate is the idea that we would insert thousands of more U.S. troops at billions of dollars to what end in Syria. And so in this politically charged campaign, I think both sides are going to be very tentative in stepping around this issue of U.S. involvement in Syria. I mean, does that make sense?
Yes. No, yeah. I agree with you entirely.
Someone's got a question for you.
I have something that happened yesterday. And the pilots were picked up, and the story was that Saudi Arabia and Qatar are after Turkey to get into this battle. And one of the reasons they want to do it is that they want to they want to embarrass Russia, who is backing Iran and Syria, and they think that this would be a good way to do it. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that logic. Whether that's actually happening or not, I don't know. But in that region, I think it's very important for folks to understand that the geostrategic contest is occurring within Islam between Sunni power center and Shia power center, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, between Arabs and Persians. I mean, that's how it lines up. So to the extent that Iran is backing their favored guy in Syria, and if Syria continues to win or wins out and Iran is able to keep its essentially a satellite state strong in Syria, that's not to Saudi Arabia's interest. So Saudi Arabia will look for any opportunity to knock Iran down however many pegs. If they can take Syria off the table, that takes away a strong ally from Iran, and that betters the hand that Saudi Arabia is playing. So it's a very convoluted mix here, but the major players are all eyeing each other through an ethnic and a religious lens for dominance within Islam and within that region. Saudi Arabia will do whatever it needs to do to maintain a dominant position within Islam, within the Sunni community, and they're going to look for opportunities to knock down Iran in that contest.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the aftermath of Benghazi, where the U.S. ambassador and detail lost their lives. Lots of finger pointing going on regarding the situation in Libya.
Can you still hear me?
It seems that the Obama administration, Dakota, is backtracking, saying that they never got the request for additional security. There are reports now that they did get that request. Be a black eye for the Obama administration?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the story has changed so many times, I've lost track of you know, who shot John. I mean, you know, it's that classic question of who knew what when. You know, what did you know? When did you know it, right? And, you know, there's all the blame put on the film as the catalyst for these uprisings, the attack on the consulate and the death of the ambassador were a direct result. That story changed. Then the administration finally admitted that Al-Qaeda was behind it, another attack. This is an administration that has said repeatedly that they have put Al-Qaeda on the ropes, that they have neutralized them as any kind of credible threat, and now we have a dead U.S. ambassador. So, it does not play well in terms of the Obama administration and the progress that they claim to have made against Al-Qaeda and against these extremist elements. Then it goes to, if you remember years ago with our effort in Somalia, there was a request made for armor. The request was denied, I believe it was by the Clinton administration, and we had a bunch of guys killed, and armor was flowed in. The State Department, the consulate there in particular, had requested additional assets for security. That request was either refused or wasn't acted upon. Less security, local guards paid pennies on the dollar, and we've got embassies in flames and a dead ambassador and some of the support staff. So it seems that the administration is trying to avoid direct responsibility, and by saying that they're investigating the matter, push out some kind of a conclusive report 3 weeks until after the election. And, I know that recently Secretary of State has claimed that she's responsible for it all, and yet we don't see anybody falling on their sword as a consequence, So I think it's the time-honored tradition of putting together some kind of a blue-ribbon panel, having an intensive investigation that takes weeks, if not months, recommendations that come out of that, decide whether to act on those recommendations, and yet nobody is ever held accountable. And I think that's what we're seeing right now.
Dakota, last question real quick on this is, was what happened in Benghazi, was it an intel failure, or was this a failure on the approach taken by either the administration or the State Department?
Yeah, I think it's three or four things. I think one is certainly intelligence. Are you actively collecting information about what's going on, and not just what, but why? Who are the personalities? What are the trend lines? So something broke down there, either in the collecting, the analysis, or in the reporting. Secondarily, the diplomatic staff that was there. It seems that the ambassador really had his thumb on what was going on, was reporting his concerns via a number of channels, but the higher-ups within the department didn't act on those concerns. The third one, then, is the security apparatus that was in place. How in the world did the ambassador get out from the security umbrella that should have been enveloping the entire time? Where was the U.S. presence or contracted presence or what have you? So there was a breakdown in that security apparatus. And then perhaps the larger thing is the U.S. diplomatic effort as a whole and our foreign policy directed to that region, where our stick apparently wasn't appreciated well enough to keep some of these other elements going. So when you have a well-orchestrated attack by Al-Qaeda that's effective, something apparently broke down. So security, diplomatic mission, analysis and action, and then the security element itself. All that, there's a multitude of failures I think we're looking at.
Hey, Dakota, on a personal level, you had a really strong showing in that Oklahoma race, surprising a lot of people. The big question now going around Washington and even parts of Oklahoma.
Oh, it cut off right at the question.
Are you done with politics, Dakota, after the strong attitude?
I've had lots of people really ask if I would try again. From my analytic viewpoint, I would have to say what conditions would change that would lead to a different outcome than what already happened. I came in with essentially zero money, very little name recognition, if any at all. The name recognition obviously has changed, but the money situation hasn't changed. If I were to run again, I'd be running against an incumbent instead of an open seat. The incumbent always has an advantage. I think the reelection rate is 90-some-odd percent. So it seems, kind of a hard hill to climb. My desire was always to do whatever I could in service to the country, an entire career in the military and the defense analytic community, et cetera. And I can't get into the details at the moment, but we're putting ink on the deal right now for me to be in a position within the special operations community and continue to support the country in that way. So I think where you know, I can provide for the family, serve the country, and do that right now. It's a better path for me at the moment with my skill sets than looking 2 or 4 years down the road and making another run at politics.
Got one last question for you, Dakota.
Dakota, not a question, but just the thought that we look forward to seeing you back here in Washington sometime soon. And it's Shelley.
Well, well, I tell you, right where you're at, the best hot wings in Washington, D.C., and one of the greatest environments I've ever been in. So, boy, I'd sure like to sit down at your table the next time I'm in town.
See for you.
It's open invitation. Hey, Dakota, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Good luck. We'll talk to you soon.
My honor. Thanks a lot, guys. Doing a great job. Bye.
That was Dakota Wood, former senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis, former congressional candidate, and longtime Marine. Hey, we're going to go in. We got 8 minutes left in the show. We're going to go into my favorite part of the show. This is Tell Me a Story, where we go around the table, talk about any of the buzz, innuendo, scoops that we've got around the Beltway. And I'm going to start, Congressman Al, tell me a story.
I have no story yet. Let's see what happens when we go around the table.
Alan Moore, tell me a story.
All right. Well, in the latest chapter of the book of the incredible shrinking majority leader of the United States Senate,
damn you,
our favorite Harry Reid, who has
your favorite target,
favorite target, who has discredited himself and embarrassed his colleagues in the Senate, most particularly when he claimed to have, in the best Joe McCarthy tradition, a secret source who assured him that for 10 years Mitt Romney paid no income taxes. And, of course, that's all been successfully put down as I said, McCarthyite tactics that, in a kind way, were inaccurate. His latest move was to call for a teleconference over the weekend of major media, not just Nevada, but national media. People thought, wow, we've been wanting to talk to Reid about his plans for the lame duck. What are we going to do about the fiscal cliff? And what's he have to say for himself about Romney now that his big reveal turned out to be naked in its own right? And he got on the phone with, 20 or more reporters, promised that they would have a chance to ask questions. And all he talked about was a diatribe against a candidate for the House, who apparently is involved in a lawsuit with the FDIC over a real estate investment gone bad, basically saying this guy's going to be in bankruptcy, which is not in any way certain or clear. So why would you want to vote for him? And proceeded to trash this House candidate, this Republican House candidate. And then when they went to questions, there were a couple of questions from Nevada reporters, and all these national reporters who got on were told, no time, sorry, end of story. He is not long for this role as majority leader or Democratic leader, shall we say, in the Senate.
Wow. Bob Hines, 6 minutes left. Tell me a story quick.
Well, Alan just said what I was going to say.
Good. Two birds with one stone. Excellent job, Alan.
Damn you. Yes.
Carl Thuban, tell me a story.
There is a name that I thought of today. It's all by the name of Murray Chotiner. I don't know if anybody remembers Murray Chotiner. He was Mr. Nixon's guy who brought up the Helen Hagen situations and other situations when Nixon was running. In the 1950s, there used to be, on the last weekend of elections, when Senator Tidings, elder Senator Tidings ran, a picture of Senator Tidings and a picture of the head of the Communist Party of the United States, and saying, this was a fellow traveler. I thought that was wrong. I still think it's wrong. And today, we're getting billboards in Ohio. Billboards in Ohio, which are talking about it's a felony for election fraud. And there's all over Ohio. We also have a person in Ohio who put on a put on a shirt, and the back it said, "Put a white in the White House." And I really hope that some of this stuff stops. I don't think it will stop before the election. I don't like that kind of stuff. I don't carry it. But I really think in this country, in America, that this is the wrong way to act.
All right. Story real quick from across the pond over in Britain. As of yesterday, a deal. Now, everybody knows I'm half Scottish, half Italian. I still keep in touch with my Scottish roots. However, the Scottish National Party has come up with a deal. The head of the party, Alex Salmond, has struck a deal with Prime Minister David Cameron to put up a Scottish independence referendum in 2014 to end the 300-year-old union contract with London. It is about 75-25 right now, but the Scottish National Party is getting a lot of momentum. We could see in 2014 an independent Scotland. They can take our lives, but they can't take our freedom. I love William Wallace. Love Braveheart.
Braveheart, here we go.
Alan Moore.
Spectre?
Yeah, oh, yes. That's going to be my closing real quick. Alan reminded me, and I wanted to bring it up in the last 3 minutes of the show. Washington lost a great, great statesman in Arlen Specter this couple of days ago. He lost his fight with cancer. Arlen Specter, longtime senator, longtime political influencer in this town. Really, really, I mean, he's been fighting this since the early 2000s and is still managed to keep a strong political career around it. It wasn't until recently that he came out of public life to fight this last days. Unfortunately, he's succumbed to that, and that's unfortunate. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the entire Specter family and the folks in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. His services will be this coming week. Also, we got word today that former presidential candidate George McGovern has entered into hospice. A statement released by the McGovern camp basically said he's in his final days. We hope it's not true. We hope that he's got several years in front of him. But unfortunately, our thoughts and our prayers also go out to the McGovern family. I believe he's resting peacefully at his home in North Dakota. So our thoughts go out to them and all the supporters. South Dakota. I'm sorry, South Dakota. With that, on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Alan Moore, Bob Hines, Carl Tuven, our special guest today, Charlie Wright. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Fantastic show. I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We'll be back next Tuesday, and as we are every week, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Bob?
The place to be.
Absolutely. Join us next Tuesday, 4 o'clock Eastern Time, for another round of Backroom Politics. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye. That's